Welcome to Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius, your source for horror, sci-fi, suspense, and all things violent.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Thank you so much for joining me today on Vicious Whispers with Mark Tullius. Today we have episode 57, and the story at the end is going to be chapter 4 of Ain't No Messiah. That audiobook is still being reviewed on ACX or Find a Way. I forget which book, which one I put it on. But they're doing the final review, so hopefully that'll be ready in a week or two. But if you want to start listening to it now, it's free. So you can go back to episode 55. I shared the first and second chapter. Last week was chapter 3. Today we are on chapter 4. So hopefully you guys are enjoying that story. Kind of a sad little story. I don't know. Kind of sucks. The guy does not have a good life. And it doesn't get much better. He does experience a lot of cool stuff along the way. But, yeah, overall, Joshua has it pretty rough. I just finished watching... I don't watch a lot of TV. But every once in a while, I'll try to watch a show with my wife. And we've been watching Messiah. And it's pretty cool to see all the similarities. Even some same exact lines. Which I don't like that as much, but it followed kind of some of the same types of things happen, which makes sense. We're both looking at the Bible and what supposedly happened with Jesus and the Messiah, and then going off of that. So that's been kind of fun to watch. We just finished the first season, and now we gotta wait a long time until the next one is out. Who knows when that will be, right? As far as everything else, I have kind of slowed down a bit with some things. I am no longer doing the writing class with my daughter. Today we'll be doing a writing session, but it'll just be her and I. Won't be filming it. I want her to understand, like, the most important thing right now is our interactions, not to fulfill the need for other people. Like, that's great if we could do it or whatever else, but I got too much shit going on. She's got a bunch of stuff going on. So having that added pressure, I just didn't need it. Plus, with the homeschooling, now I am busy with my son. Before, it was he could just read and play games, and we were getting enough stuff done that way. But now he actually has to check in online, do the Google Classrooms. I have to help him with all the exercises. And it doesn't take that much time, but between that, cooking, cleaning, and all this other shit, my day is gone before it has even really started. So, but no complaints. I got a wonderful life. Everything is cool. We're very fortunate. So, and the other nice thing is how I am working with other people right now. So right now I am not getting a lot of creative time. So I'm not getting alone time to write. By the time it's, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, I'm too tired to fucking write at all. So what I am doing instead is I'm still doing some. I'm working on, slowly working on Beyond Brightside, finishing that up. I'm beefing it up as I'm going. I just finished chapter 10, so I'm about a third of the way through going through this pass. Meanwhile, my editor is giving me back the chapter. She just gave me back 1 through 3. So as soon as I'm done, I'll do a couple more chapters, then I'll start going through her notes. And, I think so. At that rate, it's not as fast as I would like, but I'll be done with it in about 2 months. Meanwhile, John Palisano, who is doing the Trying Not to Die in the Pandemic, he's kicking ass on it. He's already got about 20,000 words done. The Trying Not to Die in 25 Perfect Days that I'll be working on with my daughter, that one is going to be a slower one. We will probably start to really develop it a little more over the next month or two, but that might be like a summer project when she doesn't have all the schoolwork and I could focus on it a little bit more. But the other one that's going really well right now is Trying Not to Die Super High with Steve Montgomery. Because I talked with Steve, we had it was about an hour long chat the other day going over exactly how I saw it. Like, he told me what happens in his story, the general idea. And then I was able to put it into scenes. I was like, okay, well, the book actually starts here. We need it to start here with the excitement. We don't need any of this backstory. It goes from here, here, here. So here's the beginning. I kind of see the middle like this. And I kind of see the end like this. And, just giving him a rough idea, rough guidelines. And he's running with it. And so he's completely the first five scenes, you know, the start of the book, the intro, act one, is really solid right now. So that's going to be fun. It's going to be an exciting book. He's coming up with some really cool stuff. So I'm looking forward to that. Not too much else going on writing-wise. So it is nice, though, that even though I'm not being super creative myself, you know, I'm still chipping away at Beyond Brightside, and I'm going to have two Try Not to Dies released this year. So that's pretty cool. And then next year, shit, we'll probably have at least three. You know, if we publish The Pandemic and the Super High one this year, next year we could easily publish 25 Perfect Days, Trying to Die in the Wild West, and Armand's Dying Days, which is a zombie novel, which I'm 100% sure on that's what it's going to be, but that's probably what it's going to be. So that will be really cool. If I can average 2, 3, 4 of those books a year, that's awesome. So really looking forward to that. And yeah, so that's where my focus is. On the physical side of things, we just got a hydro, a rowing machine, which is cool. I needed something to help with my posture, with my back, with my neck problems. Something low impact, but also good for overall body workout. So just picked that up. When my first year of college, I actually went out for, well, the coaches recruited me. They saw me in the weight room and got at Cal State Long Beach my first year there, my only year there. And they convinced me to go out for the crew team, the rowing. And I did it for, I don't know, it was probably like 3 or 4 weeks before I realized my back was just too screwed up from football to continue. And but I really enjoyed it. I knew how tough of a workout it was. So it's pretty cool having this machine, being able to use it. And so that's what I'm doing for that. And the other really cool thing I just started yesterday was, I talked about on here a bunch with the brain training. I've been doing that at Vital Head and Spine. Really super pleased with my results. The results have been amazing as far as what it's done for me. Emotionally, has been awesome. But then, I mean, we have the results of all my testing before and after, my attention and my focus, how much they've gone up. And on top of that, all my scores and all these other categories have been incredible. So the jumps I've made from that have been awesome. The problem is, can't keep going to Pasadena. That was not only the long drive, but trying to stay home, not being on the road if we don't need to, not leaving the house if we don't need to. So, but they just offered so it's still the brain training, but I'm doing it at home using the Muse headband, just a little bit of headband that goes across the front of your forehead, attaches behind your ears, super easy to do. And then there's a Mind Lift app. And so I'm able to do my brain sessions through that. Vital Head and Spine is still analyzing my results, putting in my protocol exactly what they want to work. And so I'll be doing that 5 days a week. It's an easy 15 minutes. And yeah, so far I'm enjoying that. I think next week I'm going to be jumping to 2 sessions a day. So it'll be 10 sessions a week. But still, not a lot of time. Also just started doing a 10-week challenge, 3+1 German Academy, I think that's what it's called. But I'm going to be doing that with Jake. He started it with me yesterday. I don't know how much he'll get out of it, but I'm really going to hit it because I want to improve my German, and learning this way should really be helpful. So yeah, so that's pretty much all I've been doing, keeping busy with the family and all that stuff. So I want to go get some work. I have a little bit of quiet time right now, so I'm going to jump on some Beyond Brightside. But before that, I will leave you with this. This is chapter 4 of Ain't No Messiah. Hope you guys enjoy the book. This is narrated by Rick Cheddar. All right, guys, I will talk to you next week. Have a good one. Later.
Chapter 4. It was October, and I was 10. The past year spent raking leaves, gathering wood, praying for the sins of the world. Although that last part, I had no way of knowing if I was doing it right. Father seemed pretty damn sure I wasn't. But I wasn't even pretending to pray this day, with Mother locked in her bedroom and Father delivering cookies, cakes, and his gospel to anyone who'd listen. Paul and I were out on the porch, a safe distance from the demon dog tied up in the backyard. Father's answer to the hellspawn who regularly desecrated our church. I unbuttoned my dress shirt and set it on the rail above my shoes and socks. There was no letting my brother out of my sight for even a second, so I said, come on. Paul got off the steps, leaving his shirt on because, well, he never got dirty. Mother said we have to stay on the porch. We both had a pile of rocks next to the stairs. I snatched the burnt orange one off the top of his and chucked it, the rock sailing so perfect all the way to the tree line, smacking the top of the tallest one. What'd you do that for? It's a rock. The way Paul sounded, he was going to cry any second. It's mine! I headed for the tree, the grass cool beneath my feet. Relax, I'll get it for you, crybaby. Paul leapt on my back and slid off, grabbed hold of my bad forearm and pinched me hard. Ow, damn you, I batted him away. Better not do that again. I'm not a crybaby. Last thing I wanted was to see Mother, so I said, all right, I'm sorry. I hurried across the yard over to the tree. The rock was by the trunk. I tossed it to him and told him to leave me alone. He asked what I was doing when I was two branches up, the bark digging into the bottom of my feet. I said, ain't you the smart one? Paul said something about Mother, but I was done listening. I climbed branch after branch and would have kept going, but Paul wasn't stopping. When I looked down at him, I couldn't speak. I clutched both branches, all 10 toes, curling bark. You're up too high, Paul said. There was still half a tree above me, sunlight slanting through the needles. It got better and brighter the higher I climbed, the trunk getting narrow enough that I could wrap one arm around it, branches becoming thin as my feet. This was my ascension to heaven. I had nothing to fear. My heart returned to normal, my hands stopped shaking, my left shoulder ached and my feet were cut up, but it didn't matter. I'd made it to the top. Father said the ache from my break was God punishing me. He said whenever it hurt, I should think about what I was doing, and I'd see that I shouldn't be. But being up there couldn't be wrong. After all, I was closer to heaven and to God, right? The branches came together like a seat on my own green cloud, so close to the sun sitting in the pale blue sky. It was quiet. The only thing I could hear was myself, just me and God. Seemed like if I was ever going to talk to him, this would have been the place to do it. It was just the two of us, him, all ears. But I wasn't up there to pray. I was at the top of the world, seeing things a whole new way. The end of our roof, to the right, then swampland, as far as I could see that direction. Over to my left, there were trees and more trees, two roofs, and a small clearing of grass space between. The wind blew, and I held on, my clouds swaying away. I turned toward the hill and found myself even with its top, the Durrington's faded green house on the side of it, and just beyond that, on the other side, the top of a giant white cross sticking straight into the sky. A blue station wagon drove over the hill. Father wasn't supposed to be home until dark, but he was halfway down the block before I got moving. As the car crunched onto the driveway, I was still too high to jump. I slid down the bare trunk, my t-shirt bunching up around my chest, the bark tearing into my stomach, the tender skin of my inner arms, the side of my face, my left hand smacked off a branch as I leapt and landed on my feet. The station wagon pulled up to the porch. My skin was on fire, tiny drops of blood dotting the scratches. My pinky pointed the wrong way, the capital I now an L. The car door opened and shut. Father faced the house and shouted, "Boys!" I used the bottom of my shirt to wipe off the blood and tucked it into my pants. I couldn't look at my finger, my vision going black, my ears buzzing. I put my good hand on the tree to keep from falling. I couldn't help thinking I was paying for my sins when I accidentally banged that crooked finger against my thigh. The pain focused me, and I grabbed hold of the finger and jerked it into place, my teeth digging into my bottom lip, biting back the scream wanting to erupt. Paul gave Father a huge hug. I swallowed the tears and jogged over. Paul pressed his face to the station wagon's window. "Is that what I think? It's not for you, so calm down and go open the door for us." Father lowered the tailgate and slid the giant cardboard box onto it. "Joshua, you grab that side. We'll lift on three." My hand hurt so bad I wanted to cry, but I couldn't afford Father really looking at me, asking what the hell happened. I put my cheek where the box sit, 27-inch RCA, and did my best to get my hand under it. Father picked up his side, the edge of the box crushing my fingers. You got it? Afraid of what might come out of my mouth, I picked up my end. The box was the heaviest thing I'd ever carried and pulled my fingers every step. I couldn't see Father, but he never sounded more serious when he said I better not drop it. Paul stood in the middle of the living room, looking all around. Where's it going? I kept my bloody cheek squished against the box, lifted it high to keep my side even with Father's. I didn't know what an RCA was or why Paul was so excited about it. I just knew I had to put it down, my hands all sweat and my finger a throbbing mess. Father backed up to the hallway. My bedroom. She's in there, Paul said, leaving out that Mother had been there since Father had left. Paul was her dutiful little servant, the only one allowed to see her. The box dropped an inch or so on Father's side and he grunted it back up. Do what I say, boy. Paul opened the door. I'd never been past. The room was dark, except for the slivers of light sliding under the drapes. It smelled like a midnight garden, the only room in the house not reeking of fresh-baked bread. Father told Paul to get the lights. From her chair over in the darkest corner, Mother said, "Leave them off." The box was shaken, so Father propped it on his thigh, most of the weight sliding down on me and my finger. He said, "You'll want to see this." Mother remained turned toward the drapes. I can see just fine. I've got good news, Father said. We sold them all. Cormac said they could take double what we gave them. Mother said, wonderful, in such a way that we all knew she didn't mean it. Father told me to put the box down on the bed. I did, and slid my face away, a wet slop as the blood stayed behind on the cardboard. Mother turned my way, and I was sure she could see my face even in the dark. So what is it? We weren't allowed to raise our voice inside, but that didn't stop Paul. A TV! I backed up. Television was evil. Father warned the congregation every week it would be humanity's downfall. Father patted the top of the box. Robbie's brother gave us credit. With the same voice she usually saved for me, Mother said, why all of a sudden? How can I preach about the devil if I don't know him in all his forms? Mother didn't say anything, just looked back at her curtained window. Father sounded a lot more like himself when he said, you want it or not? She didn't answer right away. Then, so soft I could barely hear, Mother said, set it on the dresser. Father fixed half-frozen pizza for dinner, the clumpy cheese and chewy pepperoni about as appetizing as raw fish. I finished two pieces and stared at the remaining 9 soggy squares there on the plate in the middle of the table. All the leftovers had run out the day before, and I was still hungry, but I didn't ask for another slice, not about to bring any attention my way. Paul sat to my right, Mother to my left, Father was across from me, the red-stained glass window that we shared with the church directly behind him. He hadn't said a word since we sat, not even the prayer. No one was talking, and we acted like everything was normal, like no one saw the purple Mother's makeup couldn't hide. She sat to my left, close enough to nudge my foot if I said something stupid. But I wasn't worried about her seeing the side of my face. She no longer looked at me unless she had to. Mother wasn't looking at her precious little Paul either. She studied her plate, picked up the pizza, forced a small bite here and there. Paul looked at Father, but only when Father wasn't looking.
When do we get to see it?
You don't, Father said. Mother flicked her eyes toward me. Did you tell him to ask that? No, ma'am.
It's not fair, Paul said. Then Father looked at him sharply, and Paul said sorry.
Mother turned to Father. What did you expect?
Father got a little loud. I expect to be listened to and not questioned.
I kept quiet, focused on both hands lying in my lap, my swollen finger throbbing worse than ever.
We're going to end this right here, Father said. That machine is for research by myself or your mother. It is not for children. It is not for you.
We both said yes, sir, because there was nothing else we could say. Father finally noticed me.
Jesus, Joshua, what did you go and do to yourself?
I turned to a Mother a little so he couldn't see my cheek. Scraped it over the trees when I was raking. I'm okay. Father shook his head and grabbed another pizza square. Think about what you're doing, son. You have to use your head.
Yes, sir. Everyone went back to not talking. Mother waited until Father cleared his plate before she said, "I won't be feeding the dog again." She slammed her fist on the table, her face twisting. "It grabbed hold of my leg." Father held up his hand. "Calm down, woman. You won't have to do it again." Mother took a deep breath and blew it out. "So it's you or Joshua. Polly's not going near that beast." Father stared at her, worked his mouth, his nostrils going. "Fine. Joshua will do it when I'm not here." I hoped I'd heard wrong. "Feed the dog?" "It's simple," Father said. "No problem at all." "He bit me." "Lower your voice," Father said. "The argument over. All you do is fill up his cup and take it out to him, but hold it high so he doesn't jump on you." I nodded. "And tell him to stop if he does. Remember, you have nothing to be afraid of." "Okay." Father shook his head. "Not like a girl. Do it loud. Dogs are no different than people," he said. "They won't listen unless you make them." The next four nights, I made sure to be somewhere else when it was time to feed Azrael. I didn't need to practice just so Father could point out all the ways I was doing it wrong. I didn't want him there to save me. Maybe I wanted to put it to the test to see if Father was telling the truth, if I really had nothing to fear. But then it was Monday and Father was gone, the backyard all mine. We were on the front porch when I told Paul to go inside. "I need to bear witness," he said. I picked up the white cup filled with food. "Watch from a window. You're not coming." The screen door banged shut behind him. I went down the steps and headed around the house. I was just in Mother's car when Azrael let out a one deep bark nearly enough to stop me. I kept walking because I had nothing to worry about. I was the Messiah. Azrael waited 5 feet away, his rope pulled tight, the chain collar sunk into the thick fur around his neck. His mouth was open, tongue out, those razor-sharp teeth protruding, the same as those that ate the flesh of Jezebel. The demon had tasted my blood. Neither one of us moved, my eyes on his on mine. Those weren't the eyes of a stupid animal. They called me to come close, willed me to slip, become fodder for destruction. The blue food bowl was across the yard alongside Father's shed. It didn't make sense walking all that way when the dog could eat off the grass. I was about to dump the cup, but our bedroom curtain shot up, Paul's wide-eyed face staring out. He was supposed to look up to me. I couldn't be a coward, so I raised the cup over my head, the dog's eyes following, the tension in his legs telling me I better put it higher. My free hand slipped into my pocket and pulled out Father's Swiss Army knife. I flicked out the blade with my fingernail, swore I'd slam it into his eye if he tried to bite me again. Under my breath, I said, "Down, down, down." Azrael stayed right where he was. The tiny knife didn't scare him. I took a step toward him. Azrael leapt for the cup, the rope holding tight, just as loud as Father. I shouted, "Down!" He dropped to the ground and stayed on his belly. I treated it like it was nothing and walked to his bowl, dumped the food right in. My insides were shaking. I turned around expecting to be knocked over, but the dog was still down, his eyes on the bowl. "It's okay," I said. "Eat." Once I backed away, Azrael crept forward and ate with ravenous intensity, his bushy tail smacking my jeans. In mere moments, he looked up from that empty bowl. I lowered the cup so he could see inside. "I don't have any more." His teeth clamped onto it an inch from my fingers, and he ripped it away. He shook it back and forth 3 times and tossed it to the side. I stuck out my hand and prayed I was right. Father would flip if I had to explain another attack and his knife stuck in his guard dog's eye. Azrael nuzzled his face against my hand and rubbed his massive shoulder against my leg. "Are you a good boy?" Azrael opened his mouth, his tongue darting over my palm. His tail swished back and forth. He was a good boy, just sad and alone. No one to love him. I folded the blade away and put it in my pocket, sat on the grass. Azrael rubbed his head against mine, kept it there. I wrapped my arm around him, pulled him even closer, his thick fur not much different than the tangled mess on my head. I called him a good boy, and he got excited, pushed me over. My shoulders hit the ground, and playtime was over. Azrael's face just inches from mine. My right hand grabbed hold of his collar. My left went after my knife. He dropped even closer, opened his mouth, and licked my face. Afraid to move fast because I might spook him, but just as worried as he might want another taste of me, I told him to get off and guided him with both hands around his collar. Back on my knees, I realized I was choking him. That metal links were already digging into his neck without my fat fingers stuck between the collar and his fur. The collar was easy to figure out and still tight once I loosened it a rung. I gave Azrael one more hug and told him his new name was Blackie. I spent nearly every night down on my knees, all alone in the church for a quiet time. That was my atonement when I prayed for the world just as mother and father insisted. That night was no different. I knelt in darkness. Quiet time, no excuse to waste electricity. It wasn't totally dark thanks to the dull red glow from the kitchen and the full moon shining through the door I'd propped open, my eyes locked on that rectangle of light. According to Father, quiet time meant 60 minutes of praying. That's what I was supposed to be doing instead of crying about my aching knees and staring at the doorway. But the longest I'd ever prayed was 3 minutes, not seeing the point in talking to someone who never talked back. I felt the 7:40 train before its rumble obliterated all sound, covering the crunch of leaves or the slithering of an unknown predator. That got me talking to God, asking him to watch over us. Don't let a demon get me or my brother. Demons were real. I had a book with their pictures and understood they could come in any form. That's why the church's windows were permanently boarded up. Like Father said, who else would hate us enough to keep breaking them? The train faded and the silence returned. Then the frogs and the birds, all the night noises stirred up again. I went back to telling myself there was nothing to worry about. Even with Father on the road, I wasn't scared. I had Blackie out back, my first friend. Another 18 minutes until I could sneak him the piece of roast I'd wrapped up in my napkin. A deep, long growl rose from the darkness. Blackie barked once. Then came a splash from the swamp. A yelp. More splashing than nothing. I couldn't run outside to check. I needed help. So I stumbled through the passage, ran into the kitchen, screaming Mother's name. She was in her bedroom, back in the corner chair outlined by the soft glow coming from the TV. Paul sat between her feet, his head on her lap. "What is it?" she asked. I stayed in the doorway. "Something hurt Azrael," I said. "Something from the swamp." Mother didn't bother looking at me, too busy stroking Paul's hair, making the curls perfect. "That rope doesn't reach the water, and gators don't come this high." "I heard it." "So when your father gets home, you can tell him what you did." "What I do?" "You were out playing with him. What did you think would happen?" Paul kept looking at the ceiling instead of at me, standing there like an idiot. "I didn't do anything," I said. I didn't touch the rope." Mother checked the clock. "Go finish your prayers and ask for forgiveness." It was 2 days later, and I still wasn't talking to the tattletale. That's why Paul was halfway up my tree, higher than I'd been, when I slipped. "Stop being stupid and get down," I said. "She'll lose it if she sees you." Paul had both arms around the trunk, his brown shirt snagging on the bark. "Forgive me." I had, but I wasn't saying it. He believed he was going to hell if I didn't say some magical words. "You're ruining that shirt." Paul reached up like he was going to climb higher. I shouted for him to get down. "You're crazy," he said. Paul hugged the tree. "Mother will come." "You're the one in the tree." Everything got quiet, both of us listening for a door. A gust of wind blew through the trees, Paul swaying, his arms wrapped around tight. "Say it first. Say you forgive me." Not saying it was too much work. "Fine. Get your butt down here before she comes out." Paul started shaking. He was too high to be doing that. His bones more delicate than mine. "I said I forgive you. Come on, Paul." "I can't." The screen door slammed shut and Mother screamed down the stairs. One slipper flew off, but she kept running, bright orange curlers twisted in her hair. "My baby, hold on." He'll be okay, I said. Paul started crying. Does that sound okay? She said. I told Paul there was a branch below to his left. Just do it real slow. As if I might have lied, Mother said, It's there, Paulie. You can do it. Paul didn't move, so I got underneath him. I won't let anything happen to you. Mother shoved me out of the way and spread her arms wide. Come on, honey, you can do it. With Mother right below him, Paul climbed down. Mother grabbed him when he came close enough and squeezed him tight. She called him Honey again, a name she never used for me. Why did you go up there? She asked. You're smarter than that. I prayed Paul knew how to lie. It looked like fun, he said. Mother said okay, and I thought that was it. Then she grabbed Paul's chin so he couldn't turn away from her. Looked? He knotted his curls, barely moving thanks to her grip. Why'd you go up that tree? You saw Joshua do it? Paul's eyes were scared. They didn't want to say yes, but they snaked toward me while his head stayed put. I wanted to say it like Father would, but it was more like a whisper when I said, I go up there to pray. Mother let go of his chin and looked down at me, her disgust no different than Father's. The hand by her side was twitching. I told you, no climbing. That hand was coming no matter what I said, so I yelled, I hate you. The complete absence of hesitation is what surprised me. Her palm smacked my cheek and her wrist smashed my nose, dropped me to my knees. The Messiah's blood sprinkled the dirt. I was 11, and in the back of the church, it was an oven. My mother even let me undo my top button, the last thing she had said after telling us to read in silence. Our notebooks were open, but no one was reading. Usually sharp like a hawk, Mother was suffering and had her eyes clenched shut, fingers kneading her forehead. Not much had changed in the last 2 years. Paul, Patricia, and David still sat where they'd always been. Sarah, a quite little mouse the same age as Paul, sat in my old seat. I had the back table to myself, no one around to see me mark the wrong answer or mumble something stupid. No one near enough to make fun of my crooked nose, my messed up hair, my stupid drawings. The timer went off and all eyes went down to our books. Mother groaned when she got up. Halfway to the curtain, she told Paul, See everyone out. Paul led a prayer and got us out of there. I closed the door behind me and watched our classmates kicking dirt halfway down the driveway. Sarah, in her blue dress, brown hair tight in a bun, was struggling to keep up with the other two. I took off my dress shirt and laid it across the counter of the baked goods stand we built for Mother that summer. Paul took off both of his shirts and laid them next to mine. I slipped off my dress shoes and turned to Paul, who was picking something off the grass. He came up with a purple flower and his gentle smile. For Mother. I said how nice, but only because he was so sensitive. He handed it to me, his eyes soft but searching. You should give it to her. I set the flower on top of my shirt. I'd just make her ask me what I'd done wrong. When she feels better, I said. Paul ran his fingers through his curls. Can't you make them go away? He meant her headaches. He always asked about them, and I always said no. I shook my head. You ever really try? What do you think? Just seems like you should be able to. I pushed past Paul and bumped his shoulder pretty hard. Yeah, no kidding. Paul followed as I walked across the four sets of parking spaces Father had already cleared for Mother's customers. Don't get mad, he said. I ain't. Yeah, you are. I stopped him with one glance. I'm getting there. His upper lip quivered and his eyes were getting ready to spill. You gotta cut that crap out. You're not going to hell. You forgive me? I said I did. And he went back to being himself, skipped over to the thick white rope tied around the tree I got my nose broke over. See, was that so hard? Mother had given the order to rip out that glorious tree the day of the incident. It had been nearly a year, but Father had barely started on it, said it'd be down by the next weekend. Paul stepped back toward me until that rope was all stretched out, a good 40 feet or so. He gave it a few twirls. Come skip for me. I was looking at the sad stack of pines piled on the ground that had become someone else's firewood, the only way we were able to ever afford meat. I got a better idea. He dropped the rope. Where are you going? I changed direction so he wouldn't follow, as the side of the church was strictly forbidden ever since Blackie was snatched. What are you doing? Why, are you going to tell on me again? I didn't wait for his answer and walked past the wall with the boarded up windows that had been painted white at least 5 times. Fake Messiah covered up, but ever present there underneath. Father camouflaged the bear traps with twigs and leaves. Easy for me to spot, but not a demon doing work under the cover at night. One of these days, Father said, we catch us a non-believer. He said he wanted to hear who they'd been praying to with 100 pounds of pressure crushing their leg. The safest form of vengeance, he argued, was hurting others before they could hurt you. Father always kept the shed locked, but the shovel and axe he left leaning against the wall for easy access. We weren't supposed to touch them, especially without him home, but the bright red handle of the axe just begged to be held. The axe was solid, the blade freshly sharpened. I liked the way it felt, 5 pounds swinging by my leg as I walked back to the front. Paul said, you're going to get busted. He'll be glad. It took him all last Saturday to cut down those 3. Paul looked at the tree that was 10 times taller than him. You want to do this one? It's next. I bet he could get a whole pew out of it. You should put it back. You telling me you don't want to try it? His eyes got so big, so saucer-like, it was almost comical. Can I? Just got to be careful. No telling Mother. Paul promised he wouldn't. That didn't mean much. Swear it on me. He'd be in deep trouble if he was heard saying that, so he checked over his shoulder, then turned back. I swear on you that I will not tell. I'd helped Father bring down enough trees to have an idea how long they took. He'd already taken a big chunk of the one on the side, but I guess it'd still take him at least 20 good swings. I figured it'd take me and Paul each about double that. I told Paul, we'll switch every 5 swings after I work on it for a bit. Paul ran back to the rope and wrapped it round his waist. He'd seen me help Father and knew what to do. This right? Yeah, but don't tie it. Wrap it once and hold it. Back up to the driveway. Paul wrapped it round himself, then bent down and wiped his hands on the grass, even though they'd be just dirty 5 seconds later. He backed up and stretched the rope tight. I leaned back and twisted my body, the axe all the way behind me. I thought of Mother and Father and Paul and everyone else who was counting on me to save them, how I'd done nothing but mess things up. I whipped around, the axe biting deep. I yanked it out, did it again. A big triangle of wood falling at my feet. I swung again and again, got into a rhythm. A thud for the sinners, a thud for the saints, a thud for the disbelievers, the ones that pointed and sneered and laughed, the ones who called me names. Paul was shouting, but I could barely hear him. Holy cow! I kept attacking the tree, didn't even notice my bad shoulder. When's it my turn? Paul yelled. I had the rhythm making music like Mother, but so much mightier. I kept whacking away and shouted, stay there, keep the tension. It's my turn. The ear-splitting crack was like lightning, but I must have yelled just as loud. Run, run! The tree began to topple, gaining speed. Paul skidded to a stop, the falling tree blocking the sun and casting him into darkness. I dropped the axe and ran for my brother, trying to outrun the tree. Paul was frozen, his entire body in the shadow of death. The whoosh rushed on as pine needles pushing down every inch of my body as I left my feet and soared through the air, pulled Paul beneath me. We smacked the ground hard, a tremendous blast of white pain ripping through my right side, the devil's fire burning through my body. Everything was black, so much pressure, like a truck had parked on my back. Paul grunted underneath, sounded like he couldn't breathe. I pushed off the grass into a new world of pain. The skin on my back tore further, the hole inside me growing wider. I reached under the right side of my chest. A slick branch protruded from the front of my shirt and pierced the ground. There was no time to worry about myself. Paul wasn't moving. Biting down, I pushed up high as I could, taking weight off Paul, digging my hand underneath me and rolling him toward the rays of light. I tried to call for help, but nothing came out. The tree sank further down, my face smashed against the grass, the shallowest breath in and out of my nose. I couldn't see Paul, couldn't breathe, wished I could tell him I was sorry.